Welcome to JFK and the Enduring Secret. I'm your host, Jeff Crudell. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to the podcast. Today's episode is episode 209. What would you say if I said there was not one, there was not two, there was not three, there was not four, there was not five, there was not six, there was not seven, there was not eight? Perhaps there was actually nine plots when you include Dallas to assassinate President Kennedy. It's a little startling when you put it that way. And so it goes that we truly couldn't leave this portion of episodes on the podcast, our study of the Secret Service, without taking a step back and discussing the nature and the timing of these plots, and especially those that occurred in late 1963, just a short time before the president's assassination in Dallas. Calling them A-plots is perhaps misleading, of course, but it was done to make you think about it for a second. Certainly, I am about to go through incidents in eight different cities. Cities where there was documented proof that an assassination attempt was being planned on the president's life and was to be effectuated in that city. The term plots implies that they were all separate and distinct, as if there were discrete forces at work in each of the locales, unconnected, except perhaps in their common hatred of the president. But as we have come to learn, using the popular vernacular, that word, the plot, well, it blinds us to the real significance of these eight drive-by episodes with fate and what they tell us when we lay them all out side by side. The real significance is that they had common characteristics, leading you to believe that they were not separate and distinct plots after all. No, no, no. Indeed, in most of these cases, the similarities are startling. And indeed, the common shadow of whoever architected the dastardly plot to kill President Kennedy, well, it hangs heavy over this combined collection of attempts. 60 years later, it's easy to see the similarities and connections. And I think a select group of people in the know at the FBI and the Secret Service saw it very clearly as well, right in the moment. So if the danger for the president was escalating in October and November of 1963, and the Secret Service knew it, why then did the Secret Service protection of the president do just the opposite in Dallas? Why then, in the face of these known threats, was the protection of the president reduced so radically in Dallas from what had just been seen in Miami and Tampa just a few days before? Why then, with active death threats present and unresolved, and specific patterns of danger already revealed, did they ignore those patterns and take no actions on the apparent warnings when the clues were right there in their own hand? Why then did they do that and leave the president totally exposed? Listening to the rest of this story today and the related chain of events that make up this catastrophe may leave you more confused about the Secret Service. It may make you more resolute that there was something very wrong inside the Secret Service, or might just lead you to pause on such conclusion and seek more clarity still, and especially more on how some of their blunders could possibly happen without a deeper explanation of why they did what they did. One thing it should do is make it obvious to an untrained eye that the Secret Service, after having lost the president, would have been dealt a death blow had anyone come to the conclusion in the immediate aftermath that they knew of a plot or the presence of an existential threat, and they just didn't take the standard security precautions that are normally taken in the face of such threat. And that, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, is without question what happened. And that will become painfully obvious in what is to come. Whether it meets the threshold of nefarious, well, I'll leave that up to you. But it certainly leaves me chock full of suspicion about a lot of things. So before we get too ahead of ourselves here, I bet you want me to enumerate the eight plots, that is, or at least the eight cities. Well, for the sake of context, let's do just that. And then, because there is only so much time left on the Wander, after that, we're going to dive right into the Chicago plot and tell that story in detail in today's episode. So here goes on the eight. Most of these plots took place in late 1963, but the earliest of them took place in 1962. It was in Springfield, Illinois, in October of that year. For you history buffs, Springfield is the home of Abraham Lincoln, and after Lincoln was assassinated, he was brought home to Springfield, where he was ultimately laid to rest. In the period encompassing the first few days of the Cuban Missile Crisis, Kennedy was in Springfield himself, and he too was on his way to visit Lincoln's tomb. The date was October 19th, and a rifle bearing a telescopic sight was spotted hanging out of a second-floor window along the motorcade route. Sound familiar? It turned out to be two young men, one age 20 and one age 16. They were brothers-in-law, and both were apprehended and taken into custody for questioning. .22 caliber and other long ammunition was found, but their story, and they stuck to it, was that they were using the gun's telescopic sight to see the motorcade better. No charges were made against either of them. And now, in this case, it doesn't seem too logical that this particular group of two gunmen would be caught up in something more nefarious. They were kids, basically. So let's move on to plot number two, the plot in Nashville. Researcher Bill Adams summarized this in 1993, saying the following. A few years ago, I began looking into other assassination sites, as well as other potential assassins and potential patsies. I was able to track a potential JFK assassin to the general area of Knoxville, Tennessee, and of a planned JFK motorcade in May of 1963. The trip was altered prior to the actual day of the trip, and JFK instead made a visit to Nashville, Tennessee. His visit took place on May 18th, 1963, and it included several motorcades that day. In early 1992, I was shocked to see a tabloid print a story about an assassination attempt against JFK during the Nashville trip. Congressman Bob Clements of Tennessee had made a startling revelation. He said his father, the late Governor Frank Clement, who was governor of Tennessee back in 1963, told him of a strange incident that occurred while JFK awaited a helicopter after visiting the governor. The tabloid quoted Congressman Bob Clement of Tennessee as stating, "While the president waited for the helicopter, a man approached with a gun, hidden underneath a sack. Secret Service agents spotted him and grabbed him." "I called and interviewed the congressman," said Adams, "in the early summer of 1963. I also obtained actual Nashville news stories about the congressman's revelation in January of 1992. As a result of reading the news stories and talking to Congressman Clements, I have been able to piece together the following story." President Kennedy arrived in Nashville on May 18th, 1963. He rode in a motorcade to Vanderbilt University, where he gave a speech outside in the football stadium. JFK left the stadium in another motorcade and drove to the governor's mansion. Somewhere between the governor's mansion and the helicopter landing site at Overton High School, a man approached JFK with a handgun under a sack. It is unclear whether JFK was in his limousine or not at the time. The governor witnessed this event and the subsequent capture of the suspect by the Secret Service. The man was held at the high school for some time. Nothing more is known about the man. The Secret Service asked the governor to keep the event out of the press for fear it would lead to more assassination attempts. And by the way, there are no records anywhere of the detainment of this individual. No fingerprints, no police record. Now, let's call the Los Angeles plot, plot number three. We know, according to Dick Russell's accounting of it in his book, The Man Who Knew Too Much, and I'll read directly from it now, that President Kennedy was scheduled to come to Los Angeles in June of 1963, and according to Richard K. Snagel, a second plot to assassinate him was being discussed among some Cuban exiles in the spring of 1963. And as I say, a second plot, one that was much more seriously considered than in their first proposal in Miami that began to take shape in the previous winter. In Los Angeles, it was to take place, Nagel says, during the showing of the movie P.T. 109 at the Beverly Hills Hilton Hotel in Beverly Hills. In June of 1963, of course. The man being looked at for the recruitment as a shooter was Von Marlow, and if you can believe it, he was an executive officer of the Los Angeles chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. His true name back in the early 1960s was Von L. Snipes. And you might recall all of this from our earlier episodes of JFK, The Enduring Secret, which covered the Richard K. Snagel matter. Dick Russell gained access in 1986 to a file of material that Nagel had provided over the years to a since-retired LAPD officer who was with the Organized Crime Bureau. Included in that file was a telegram that Von Marlow used, deploying the pseudonym John M., and it was a telegram that he had sent Nagel while Nagel was still in prison. The Western Union message of April 1, 1964, from Santa Monica, California, looked innocuous enough. Sent through the care of an El Paso attorney, it read, and I quote, "Surprised to hear that you did not receive my holiday greeting card. The PO employees must be overworked. I sent it long ago. Good luck, John M." At the bottom of that page was a typed paragraph by Nagel, and Dick Russell would read it, and what he would read would stun him. And here's how it read, from Nagel. "The original of the above Xerox copy of a telegram is a significant piece of hard evidence substantiating the existence of a conspiracy to assassinate President Kennedy. The copy contains a coded message and was sent to me at El Paso in April 1964, before my first trial on the merits, and it was sent by Von L. Snipes, a.k.a. John Miller and Don Gordon." When Jim Garrison's investigation was made public in 1967, Von Snipes sent a letter to the Orleans Parish DA's office attempting to disavow any unlawful connection with me, that is Nagel. "Actually, I had investigated Snipes and his wife, Priscilla, in conjunction with my inquiry about Oswald. One of the two Cubans who were associating with Oswald in August and September 1963, who, by the way, also fits the description of one of the two Cubans who allegedly visited Sylvia Odio at Magellan Circle with Oswald the day before his trip to Mexico in September of 1963, well, one of those two Cubans was witnessed entering the, and the name of it was, On the Beach bookstore on two separate occasions while he was under surveillance. The bookstore was located in Venice, California, and Von L. Snipes was the proprietor. Snipes, who once boasted that he was a good shot with a rifle, was considered for recruitment to hit JFK in June of 1963 during his visit to the Beverly Hilton Hotel. That project never materialized. Well, there you have it. That was pretty intense, wasn't it? Not only do we have a common thread of members of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, but by mid-1962, Von Marlow also had become a leading organizer for the Congress of Racial Equality, or CORE. Remember that organization from our earlier episodes on the Clinton witnesses? I know. Again, assigning these incidents with plot numbers is totally arbitrary on my part for those listening, and just a way to keep track of them during the episode. In this last discussion, the so-called plot in L.A., well, the L.A. story clearly indicates that there are other incidents that I'm not counting for purposes of this exercise. And so it reinforces that this is not a definitive list. For instance, shouldn't I count the earlier organizing attempt in Miami mentioned by Nagel in the prior year by Cubans, coming from the story that I just mentioned? And technically, the L.A. attempt never materialized. Oh, and while we're at it, there is one of the very first attempts on Kennedy's life that almost took place at the Kennedy compound in Palm Beach, and I haven't counted that one either. So you get my point. I'm only pointing these particular incidents out and giving them numbers because they are part of this episode. That's all. But isn't 8 enough, for God's sake? Fast forward to plot number 4 in early October of 1963, the Washington, D.C. plot. Not much is known about this supposed plot, other than it's one that Lee Harvey Oswald may have had some connection to, further implicating the idea that some of these plots were interconnected. Oswald expressed interest in moving to Washington around this time. We know from Dick Russell's book on Richard Case Nagel that Nagel may have urged Oswald not to participate in this plot. But like so many of the things that Nagel espoused over the years, the letter he refers to in this instance, the letter that he wrote to Oswald saying that, are nowhere to be found. In other research, including some contained in one of Vince Palomara's books, there appears to be evidence that someone might have been impersonating Oswald in the Washington area at a time when he was ostensibly known to be in Mexico City. Nevertheless, we do know that Oswald himself was actually thinking of moving to Washington, D.C. right around that time, as he wrote a series of letters which included one to the Communist Party USA indicating that he was thinking of moving to Washington, D.C. Oh, and one final add to this story. Captured in the Joseph Miltier surveillance tape that discusses the possibility of shooting the president as he occupied the White House and stepped out onto the White House lawn. By the way, the Joseph Miltier affair is another key element to all of this, and it's a fascinating yet chilling story to tell, and it's coming shortly as part of this final sequence of episodes on the Secret Service. Well, enough about Washington. Let's fast forward about 30 days and get to the focus of our episode today, which is the Chicago plot. And I'll call the Chicago plot, plot number 5, for purposes of accounting for the previously stated number of plots or locations of a potential assassination attempt, which I said was 8. Maybe you could put the previous 4 incidents leading up to Chicago in the category of an unrelated warm-up, because there is no doubt they may or may not have been part of something larger. Certainly, it appears that the Los Angeles incident certainly was. One does have to keep in mind that presidents, any president, is the recipient of death threats. Sadly, that happens in any political environment. But the intensity of the kill buzz around JFK was clearly heating up in the fall of 1963, and Chicago was where the plots began cooking with gas. That's why, we are going to tell the story of those events today as they played out in Chicago at the end of October 1963, culminating with the events of November 2nd, just 20 days before the actual assassination. And by that time, I will definitely be hungry for a sandwich, which is why we are going to leave the Joseph Miltier story in plots numbers 6, 7, and 8, that is Miami, Tampa, and San Antonio, for the episodes which follow this one. So stay tuned. And boy, are those doozies. So, without further ado, let's listen to the rest of episode 209 of JFK, The Enduring Secret. As the story progresses, you will hear that there are not much in the way of records related to the Chicago plot. Early on, a call from Secret Service head James Rowley to Martin Martinow, the head of the Secret Service office in Chicago, would make it clear that the vast majority of the communication and documentation would be transmitted orally and through phone calls. Shortly after the incident took place, the modicum of written documentation was gathered up, and a member of the Secret Service team in Chicago couriered the documents to a commercial flight, where they were received and taken to Washington, D.C., ostensibly to be placed in some form of secret custody, and I assume under the purview of Secret Service head James Rowley. With that in mind, it is widely held that the most exhaustive recount of the event is through the investigative reporting that was undertaken by Edwin Black, a journalist in that era. In the late 1960s, he initiated his investigative reporting efforts on behalf of the Atlantic Monthly, a magazine that many of you, I am sure, are familiar with. Not long after, he came under the scrutiny of the Defense Intelligence Agency and one or more of its operatives. He set aside the investigation for about 5 years and then resumed it, ultimately publishing what is arguably the most exhaustive and wide-reaching account of the matter, publishing it on November 5th, 1975, in the Chicago Independent, a local Chicago newspaper in existence at the time. As part of that article, he wrote a preamble discussing in more detail the pretense that I've just briefly described to you. In an actor's voice, we'll begin by listening to Edwin Black discuss the challenges and difficulties in getting to the truth of this matter. After that, I am going to read to you the rest of the exposé in its entirety that was published in the Chicago Independent by Edwin Black. Others in the JFK research community do have important contributions to the story, and we'll add some of those as a postscript after we listen to Black's exposé. As you know, Andrew Bolden, the first Black Secret Service agent to participate on the White House detail, was originally assigned to the Chicago office, and he returned there after his brief time on the White House detail. He doesn't say much about the Chicago plot in his one and only book, Echoes from Dealey Plaza. That book recounts more of the personal odyssey and catastrophe that he was subject to as a result of attempting to speak out during the aftermath of the assassination regarding the shortcomings of the Secret Service as it related to the president's protection, and of course what happened to Bolden as a result. Not only did he see those shortcomings close up and firsthand, but he was also right there in the Chicago office during the thick of it as the Chicago plot was unfolding. He was not involved in the investigation of the plot itself, but he was in the office with those that were. So, water cooler talk and all, I'm sure were part of what he came to know. And no doubt, he learned much by being inside the den. We'll spend a few minutes on what Bolden thought as well, as a result of some of his interviews with other authors. So let's pivot now to that preamble statement by Edwin Black.
5 years ago, on commission from Atlantic Monthly, I began investigating a Chicago conspiracy to assassinate President John F. Kennedy. Just 20 days before Dallas. When I asked the wrong questions, and came too close to sensitive information, I was followed and investigated by a Defense Intelligence Agency operative. By examining my own file, I identified him and embarrassed the Defense Intelligence Agency into halting the harassment. There's a record of their project in the Credit Bureau where it began. The name of the Credit Bureau was the Credit Information Corporation, named Cook County Credit Bureau at the time. The Defense Intelligence Agency's inquiry listed my employer as Atlantic Monthly, although that assignment was my only work for the magazine. Unfortunately, the harassment didn't end until after my apartment was broken into. No valuables were taken, but all my files were obviously and clumsily searched. But that was 5 years ago, before Watergate, a different era. Today, when reporters edge close to dirty government secrets, it is the agencies who become nervous. And they think thrice before attempting the retaliation and tactics once common to the game. My investigation, revived within the past 8 months, took me to New York, Long Island, Houston, and Washington, as well as through courts, warehouses, police stations, and federal offices in Chicago. Hundreds of hours scrutinizing federal, state, and local documents, dozens of interviews, hundreds of leads. And always with the Secret Service and FBI working against me. Doing what they could to make the investigation tedious, time-consuming, and expensive. Perhaps they hoped the investigation would just disappear for all the obstructions. I hope they now know, they must come up with the answers. It is simply unacceptable to wait until the 21st century for the release of 70 or so top secret Warren Commission documents. Signed, Edwin Blake.
There are strong indications that four men were in Chicago to assassinate John F. Kennedy on November 2, 1963, 20 days before Dallas. Here's how it happened. November 2, 1963, JFK was scheduled to attend the Army Air Force game at Soldiers Field. Plans called for him to arrive at O'Hare around 11 a.m. and then motorcade down what was then known as the Northwest Expressway to the Loop. At Jackson, the caravan would lumber up the Jackson exit, make that slow, difficult left-hand turn onto the street, and shuttle over to the stadium. The Jackson exit would be crowded with no fewer than 45 local school and civic organizations anxious to see the president. As in Dallas, JFK's limousine would pass through a warehouse district, which Secret Service advance men considered 10 times more deadly than any office building corridor. As in Dallas, JFK's limousine would be forced to make a difficult 90-degree turn that would slow him down to practically a standstill. As in Dallas, triangulation of fire would be simple because of the unobstructed view. As in Dallas, the crowd would panic, allowing the assassins to escape unnoticed. Wednesday, October 30th, 3 days before a coordination meeting was held in the anteroom to Mayor Daley's fifth-floor City Hall office. Attending were various Secret Service officials, three deputy chiefs of police, and Captain Robert Linsky, the security liaison between the Chicago Police and the Secret Service. As the security plans for Kennedy's visit were mapped, each deputy chief was assigned an area of responsibility. Patrol Deputy Rockford took the airport. Traffic Deputy Motti took the motorcade route and its precarious passage under those deadly overpasses. Captain Linsky took the Conrad Hilton, the stadium itself, and various street security functions. Mayor Daley's special events man, Jack Riley, stopped in to extend his boss's hope for a safe visit. A few hours after that meeting adjourned, the phone rang in the Chicago office of the Secret Service. Agent J. Lawrence Stocks was, for a few hours, the ranking agent, so he took the call. It was the Federal Bureau of Investigation calling from Washington. The FBI man warned Stocks of a serious and dangerous four-man conspiracy to assassinate Kennedy at the Army-Air Force game. The suspects were right-wing paramilitary fanatics, armed with rifles and telescopic sights. The assassination itself would probably be attempted at one of the Northwest Expressway overpasses. This information came from an informant named Lee. Stocks turned to the other people in the office and with disbelief related the information, adding words to the effect that the FBI wasn't sure how to handle the threat. These men were not the typical nuts with a cheap handgun or some irrational score to settle. They were organized, paramilitary assassins. It wasn't a federal crime to kill a president or even threaten him at that time, and J. Edgar Hoover had decided, since it was the Secret Service's province to protect the president, the FBI would not, could not, participate in the investigation. Shortly thereafter, the TWX, or Interoffice Teletype, clanged out confirmation of the conspiracy from the office of Chief James Rowley, head of the Secret Service in Washington. His instructions were to call every available man in from every other detail and concentrate them in a coordinated blanket investigation to locate the assassins. The teletype added that this would not be an FBI matter, but would be handled strictly by the Secret Service. The buck had officially been passed. The Chicago office was critically understaffed and unprepared for such a crisis. Only 8 men for all assignments, counterfeiting, presidential protection, and so on. So reinforcements were sent in from other offices around the country. Most notable, Myron Weinstein, a crack agent called in from Minneapolis. A break came the next day, Thursday, October 31st. A near North rooming house landlady telephoned the Chicago police with a tip. 4 men were renting rooms, and in one of them, she observed 4 rifles with telescopic sights. Inasmuch as she knew the president was coming to Chicago in 2 days, perhaps there was some threat here. Would the police look into it? The police immediately informed the Secret Service. Acting agent in charge, Maurice G. Martinow, scooped up the message and made the connection. This was it. A 24-hour surveillance was set up on the rooming house. Agent J. L. Stocks spotted and followed 2 men fitting the landlady's description, all the time maintaining radio contact with Martinow. Stocks was growing tired when the subject's vehicle headed back to their rooming house in the vicinity of Clark and Davidson. Stocks, maintaining a discreet distance, followed their car into an alley behind the rooming house. Unfortunately, it was a one-way alley. When suddenly the subjects decided not to park in the alley and turned around to exit, they were forced to squeeze past Stocks' car. Stocks saw the men driving his way, tried to maneuver his car around in time, but couldn't. A message came across the radio before Stocks could reach over and turn the volume button down. As the suspects passed Stocks' car, they heard the radio message, looked him in the eye, and took off. Stocks reluctantly reported to Martinow that the surveillance was blown before any real evidence could be amassed. Martinow thought, bust them now, with or without the evidence. The 2 men were taken into custody, but not actually arrested or booked, in the very early Friday morning hours and brought up to the Secret Service headquarters. There are no records that any weapons were found in their possession or back at the rooming house. The interviews and interrogation were conducted by Agent Stocks in the front interrogation office and Agent Robert Motto in the rear interrogation office. Motto's suspect was of large build with an extremely large head and mangy hair, wearing a short-waist jacket. By 10 a.m., the interviewing agents had coaxed nothing out of their suspected assassins. The only record of their effort was the dozens of half-empty styrofoam coffee cups scattered throughout the office. When the other agents in the office heard of Stock's rookie error, they couldn't believe it. Every time Stock emerged from interviewing his suspect, the agents would drop comments, crack jokes, and make fun. Blocking the alley on a surveillance? Thomas D. Strong, who fashioned himself above such mistakes, led the ribbing. Over and over again, he took the opportunity to get a little dig. Stocks hated it. Meanwhile, two other agents had been following up on a highly suspicious yet bum lead. The man's name was Thomas Arthur Valley, a 30-year-old ex-Marine classified extreme paranoid schizophrenic by military doctors. Valley worked as an apprentice at IPP Litho Plate at 625 West Jackson. As a patsy, he was perfect. As perfect for the Chicago assassination plot as Lee Harvey Oswald was for the Dallas assassination plot. Valley was born and raised in Chicago. Like Oswald, he joined the Marines in the mid-50s during the Korean War period. Like Oswald, Valley was assigned to a U-2 base in Japan. Oswald at Camp Otsugi, Valley, Camp Otsu. The cover reference for the U-2 project at these bases was Joint Technical Advisory Group, or JTAG. Since the CIA exercised a strong presence at these two bases, they were prime recruitment stations. Both Valley and Oswald appeared to have been recruited by the CIA for black missions or otherwise unsavory, personally discrediting assignments. In Oswald's case, at the height of the Cold War, he was instructed and helped to defect to Russia. With him, he carried top-secret radar codes. Oswald's mission, probably unbeknownst to him, may have been to reveal this information for some complex CIA intelligence stratagem. Warren Commission testimony documents that all these radar codes had to be revised because of Oswald's defection. Valley was recruited about the same time to train members of a fiercely anti-Castro guerrilla group. The objective? The assassination of Fidel Castro. The training locale? In and around Levittown, Long Island. Neither Valley nor Oswald received money for their clandestine duties. The surreptitious nature of their business was ego-building to their personalities, inherently rewarding. Both Valley and Oswald had recently taken jobs in warehouses at the planned assassination sites. Oswald at the fifth floor depository on Elm Street in Dallas. Valley on the third floor of the IPP Printing Company, looking out over the Jackson Street exit ramp where Kennedy's limousine would have been hit. Both Valley and Oswald could be shown to have extremist political views. Both owned rifles. Both were basically loners, basically drifters, basically lowlife. The dregs of society. Perfect for the work they were recruited for. Perfect for a frame-up. They even resembled one another physically. Now let's turn to the arrest by Daniel Groth. While Agent Stocks was chasing his suspects around town, two other agents were acting on their tip about Thomas Arthur Valley, a violence-prone John Bircher. Information received accused Valley of threatening to assassinate Kennedy during his Chicago visit. The source of the tip is unknown. But whoever pointed out Valley knew his history and personality and how law enforcement would react to him. In fact, Valley had spoken bitterly of JFK, blaming him for pulling air support off the Bay of Pigs invaders. "We lost a lot of good men down there," Valley would say. In his mental state, he may have verbalized death threats against the president. But he does not appear to have been connected to the real threat. That is, the four other men referred to in the Secret Service teletype. The problem was, when two Secret Service agents surreptitiously visited Valley's uptown flea bag at Paulina and Wilson. They observed weaponry that classed Valley as more than a loudmouth. An M1, a carbine, a handgun, and 2,500 rounds of ammunition. With the other members of Chicago's dismally understaffed Secret Service office following other leads, the two agents telephoned Captain Robert Linsky with a request to provide 24-hour surveillance on Valley, requesting that he, and I quote, be gotten off the street. Linsky was just about to enter a second special security coordination meeting, this one in the auditorium of police headquarters at 11th and State. The president was due in tomorrow, and Linsky had the massive security task of Soldiers Field, the Conrad Hilton, and downtown streets to cope with. He made some telephone calls requesting two sharp cops. One of the city's sharpest teams was selected, Daniel Groth and Peter Schirla, both working out of the task force, specifically the pickpocket detail. They were alert, sensitive, street tough, efficient. They took orders like sponges take water. Groth and Schirla dropped everything and whipped over to 11th and State to attend this second security conference. Linsky gave them their instructions. They left the meeting and set out to find Valley. He hadn't committed any crime yet. Remember, in those days, threatening a president's life was no specific crime. The gun laws probably allowed him to keep the weapons as well in his home. The surreptitious visiting agents had nothing more on Valley than a tip. But Groth and Schirla knew their job. Get Valley off the street. On November 2nd, Saturday morning, Groth and Schirla had been tailing Valley for some time when they decided the moment was right. Valley's white Ford Falcon was curbed by their unmarked car as he turned west onto Wilson from Damon, heading toward the expressway entrance. What was their excuse? A left-hand turn without a proper signal. The time? 9 a.m., just 2 hours before Kennedy was scheduled to parade down the northwest. On Valley's front seat, in open view, a hunting knife. Perfect. Groth charged Valley with unlawful use of a weapon, the knife, and failure to signal a left turn. A search of Valley's person and the front of his car revealed no firearms, but when they opened the trunk, they found 750 rounds of ammunition. Valley had purchased the ammo at the Lawrence Avenue Sears just a short time before. Right around those moments, the Diem brothers in Vietnam were assassinated. The international dateline places an imaginary day between Chicago and Saigon. Bar November 2nd is their November 1st. And it was very early that Saturday morning, November 2nd, when the news hit Chicago. The Diem brothers, the corrupt rulers of South Vietnam, had been assassinated by a CIA-backed coup, by CIA-sponsored assassins. Obviously, the situation there could no longer be tolerated by a powerful right-wing military faction in America. The Diem brothers just weren't running an efficient anti-communist campaign. They refused to operate as American powers that be dictated. They were an obstacle. They were eliminated. The method? Executive action. Terminate with extreme prejudice. At home, the same powers were frustrated and unbelieving. This JFK must be some sort of a traitor. In addition to this civil rights nonsense, this silliness about moving to repeal the oil depletion tax, this traitorous deal with Khrushchev, promising never to invade Cuba, and in so doing selling out the Cuban people and tacitly endorsing Dr. Castro. In addition to all that, this son of a bitch Kennedy was soon to announce that Vietnam was a great mistake for America. The bastard was soon to announce all our troops would be home by Christmas. First he sold out Cuba to the Russians, now South Vietnam to the Red Chinese. Like Diem, Kennedy was an obstacle. Captain Linsky was in his downtown office when his phone rang and the notice came in of Valley's capture. Groth and Sherla were already escorting Valley to the Damon Avenue police station, where he was interrogated about his political views by detectives John Madden and Lawrence Coffey. Valley warned that the country was in, and I quote, serious trouble, unless Barry Goldwater would be elected over Kennedy, and ranted about how only Mayor Richard Daley's crooked machine could ensure Kennedy the ghost votes he needed to beat the conservative Republican. Madden, and I quote, invited Valley to take them back to his Paulina Street apartment and permit them to search. There was no time for a warrant. The president would be in Chicago in under an hour. When Valley refused, Madden threatened to drag Valley into the back room. Valley chose to open his apartment to their search. Madden and Coffey sped with Valley over to the uptown address, not knowing they were worried about the wrong man. With information supplied by the two Secret Service men, they knew exactly what they were looking for. They seized Valley's M1, his matched carbine, and 2,500 rounds, all purchased in New York. Valley was transported to the 20th District, where he was locked up during the hours the president was expected to be in town. Back at Secret Service headquarters, Motto and Stocks still couldn't break their suspected conspirators. The minutes were counting down till Kennedy's arrival at O'Hare, less than an hour away, and still the two remaining conspirators, if they existed, couldn't be found, couldn't be traced. The two suspects, pinched the day before, remained in custody while Motto and Stocks hit the streets. Motto raced over to Soldiers Field, checking the area around Kennedy's seats. Two sections were reserved for him, one on the Air Force side, a second on the Army side. The president was scheduled to change sides during halftime. The assassination of the Diem brothers shocked Kennedy and his close advisors, but the Chicago visit would not be canceled. Instead, Pierre Salinger announced at 9:30 a.m. a special communications facility would be rush constructed under the Soldiers Field bleachers to keep the president informed on up-to-the-minute developments in coup-torn South Vietnam. He reiterated Kennedy would not cancel the trip. But developments in downtown Chicago apparently were far more threatening than what was going on in Saigon. Two men were in custody in Secret Service headquarters. This Thomas Arthur Valley character in custody and his weapons confiscated. But if the original FBI information was accurate, two of the four alleged conspirators were still at large, probably armed. They were not frenzied maniacs racing across hallways or intersections with cheap pistols in their hands. They were cool, militarized assassins. Identity completely unknown. Waiting somewhere in Chicago with loaded rifles. 10:15 on Saturday, November 2nd. People in Washington, aware of this unsettled security problem in Chicago, absolutely refused to allow the president to fly to Chicago. The visit is canceled at the very last minute. The press corps' jet has even taken off. The excuse? Kennedy had to stay close to developments in Southeast Asia. Phones rang in Chicago bringing the news of JFK's cancellation. This was unheard of. No notice at all. Someone hired sound trucks to cruise up and down the motorcade route, announcing the cancellation over the loudspeakers to the waiting crowds. Mayor Daley was picked. Thousands more who had lined the streets, especially on Jackson Boulevard, were sorely disappointed. But a handful of agents and investigators were intensely relieved. The two suspects could no longer be held without an iota of evidence. They were released from Secret Service custody. However, the shadow of the assassins followed JFK wherever he went from that moment on. An identical warning of an assassination conspiracy was teletyped to the New Orleans office of the FBI just before Kennedy's visit there on November 17th. A copy of the teletype was recently acquired by CBS News and televised along with an interview of the man on duty when it comes across. That plot was probably assigned to a second team. There is no record of any New Orleans arrests, but obviously the plot was either neutralized or aborted for some reason. It didn't stop JFK from safely visiting New Orleans. It also didn't stop him from visiting Dallas November 22nd, just 20 days after Chicago. As he drove over the most precarious of routes through a warehouse district on Elm Street that had not even been covered by the Secret Service advance men as the motorcade lumbered to a fatal pause in Dealey Square, shots split through the cheering crowd. Kennedy's head exploded into tremendous bloody bits. They finally got him. Okay, we're going to pause there. The story contained in the Chicago Independent is actually more exhaustive than that. While we've just told you the actual story that relates to the plot, Edwin Black included a riveting storytell around the investigation itself, their investigation, and the wander that they had to go on over a multi-year period to get at the truth. It's too long for today's episode, but maybe we'll do it in a bonus at some point. Regardless, you'll find a copy of that document under episode 209 on our website at www.podcastjfk.com. There is more to say about the Chicago plot, and other JFK researchers have relevant comments. Perhaps the Chicago story ends right here, but at the very least, it has more than one hanging chad. There were four men associated with the original threat, and only two of them were ever physically ID'd. To this day, we still don't know who they are. But we do know that perhaps the two that were picked up had Hispanic names, Rodriguez and Gonzalez. The records are nowhere to be found, and at that very moment, if the landlady was right, there were four men in total. And so now we have two sophisticated paramilitary hitmen on the loose. Regardless of whether they could detain those two men, one would have thought that those gentlemen couldn't have gone to the bathroom without a Secret Service or FBI escort. Who in their right minds would let either one of those two men apprehended go without a tail? Can you believe any of this? As secretive as the Secret Service was at the time about the Chicago plot, indeed, some things still did leak out contemporaneously. Years later, as the Garrison investigation began to heat up in December 1967, and as the government lawyers were engaging in the Bolden matter, the CIA prepared an internal memo regarding news articles covering elements of the Bolden case and the Chicago plot. Indeed, there were a few mentions of things right at that very moment. In the November 26, 1963 edition of the Chicago American, just days after the president's assassination, in the column entitled Daily Diary by Magus Daly, there was reported a rumor that the assassination of the president was planned at a meeting on Chicago's West Side in the early part of February 1963, by a dissident Cuban group, and that the FBI was investigating that group. A memorandum in the file of one Richard S. Kane, dated November 29, 1963, just 1 week after the president's death. The memo stated that a group known as the CHECOMS had taken over the U.S. operations of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee, and that in February 1963, a secret meeting was held at 907 South Spaulding, Chicago, under the direction of Richard Criley, who was the then secretary of the Chicago chapter of the Fair Play for Cuba Committee. At this meeting, the assassination of the president was discussed. The CIA was in contact with Kane, and Kane stated that they had strong suspicion that Lee Harvey Oswald was in Chicago in April 1963, but they were unable to confirm whether he was in attendance or not at the February Chicago Fair Play for Cuba meeting, where the assassination was discussed. Richard Kane, at the time, was a high-ranking investigator for the Cook County, Chicago Sheriff's Office. For a time, he was a major source for the federal government of information on dissident Cubans in the Chicago area. In May 1967, the FBI informed the CIA that they were investigating Kane for his alleged ties with the mafia, and the CIA was advised to discontinue their contact with him. More to come on Kane, but oh, what a web they weave, and who to believe. 5 years after the assassination, Bud Fensterwald, who was, at the time, a Senate investigator, came across several newsmen at the Chicago Daily News who knew about the Chicago plot but did not write about it. But Fensterwald himself wrote a memo about that. It appears that both JFK and RFK were apprised, of course, of the assassination plot. Obviously, that is true because the trip was canceled. And yet the records were being kept so secret. Was it simply the basic security premise that these attempts should be kept silent? Surely that makes sense. But the extreme to which they went to keep all records oral, to avoid documenting or writing almost anything, and to have that order come directly from the Secret Service chief in Washington, and for the FBI to stand down, well, both those things are oddities. Could it have been nothing more than a sibling rivalry between the FBI and the Secret Service? And that's why the FBI offered no help? Either way, it seems odd, quite odd. But perhaps this was Hoover maneuvering to assist the Secret Service in its failure to perform. He was, by all accounts, attempting to co-opt the agency. And surely he knew that the Secret Service had only 8 men in the office for all of Chicago. Or was there something more afoot here that was less nefarious, and perhaps came directly from the White House itself? Without going into any detail, we'll leave that question for a different time and a different bat channel, so to speak. But I will give you a little bit of a hint. Researchers and writers Lamar Waldron and Tom Hartman believe that a second invasion and coup in Cuba, that is the JFK Almeida plan, was imminent. And their assertion is that any press around any type of Cuban retaliation might jeopardize the plan. So the attempt, which may have been seen as retaliation from Castro, had to be quashed. There were reports of Cuban agents in Chicago around this time. Regardless of all of that, though, a clear template was established in Chicago. A huge set of clues that, if applied to the next set of venues, using what you heard Paul Blow and Jim DiEugenio speak to on our most recent YouTube episode, well, if comparative case analysis would have been applied, the pattern beginning right there in Chicago would start to be recognizable. And less than 2 weeks later, it would outright be confirmed when an undercover informant would tape Joseph Miltier describing the plan that was already in play to get the president. Sadly, the Chicago plot was sealed up and not passed along to the Secret Service advance men who were responsible for planning Miami, Tampa, and the Texas trips, including Dallas. Only the Miltier reconnaissance was captured by local law enforcement in Miami, so it couldn't be snatched and stowed away. It was there for the local authorities to react to. And so things were different in the state of Florida, in Miami and Tampa, compared to Dallas. Miami and Tampa had larger, more aggressive Cuban populations that were more likely to be problematic for the president, inherently more dangerous. And yet, ironically, because of the Miltier intercept, there was a deluge of security added. But after the Secret Service crossed the state line and headed west to Louisiana and Texas, any conscious effort to heed the warnings was lost in the wind. Maybe you can't fault those men like Winston Lawson, who likely never knew about the Chicago plot and the Miltier surveillance matter just weeks before. So maybe we should give them a break and look straight at Secret Service Chief James Rowley. But honestly, it's hard not to point the finger at all of them. They had a duty of care that involved communication amongst them on matters of such importance, regardless of what was stated or not stated in a manual somewhere. Common sense would tell you that anyone who was there and part of the Miami or Tampa trips and who was privy to the extraordinary information about the Chicago plot or the Miltier tape is culpable and responsible. All of them long gone now, but God, what it must have been like to carry what Vince Palomara describes as survivor's guilt. Thank you for listening to episode 209 of JFK, The Enduring Secret.